You've got to be really clear with the board. What is the set of capabilities you have at this stage? What's the set of capabilities you need for the next stage you're going to? Who can grow into that? And then who are you going to have to place to get that next level of player on the team?
Welcome to the Authentically Successful Show, an entrepreneurship podcast that delivers you real stories and advice from successful founders and CEOs in various industries. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, a longtime professional recruiter, executive coach, thought leader, and creator of talent-centric organizations. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Authentically Successful. I'm Carol Schultz, and joining me today is Randy Wooden, CEO of Maxio, a financial operations platform designed to help B2B SaaS companies unlock their next stage of growth. He's a go-to-market executive who has been helping marketing and sales tech companies develop and scale their SaaS capabilities for over two decades. Randy's last role was as a chief strategy officer and president of Percolate, a seismic company, where he led the acquisition of two companies, Grapevine 6 and Lessonly, deploying $300 million in capital, as well as their strategic investment in Tiled Inc. Before selling Percolate to Seismic in 2019, he was CEO and led Percolate's transformation from a mid-market social media product to an industry-leading content marketing platform for the largest companies in the world. And prior to Percolate, he served as CEO of Rocket Fuel, where he led its transition and repositioning from a tech-enabled service business to the leading predictive marketing platform. Ultimately, he sold Rocket Fuel to a PE firm in 2017. And during his career, we'll talk about this more, Randy also held senior positions at both Microsoft and Salesforce, leading sales, service, and marketing teams. Randy, glad to have you on the show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So what is the biggest problem Maxio is solving for its clients?
Right. So we focus on B2B SaaS companies in particular. One of the big challenges for B2B SaaS is revenue recognition. And that was initially driven by 606, it was accounting regulation and how you do revenue recognition and revenue reporting. And what that led to is a lot of people saying, gosh, how do I recognize revenue? Which translates into things like an MRR schedule and your ARR. And I was talking to a guy who ran M&A at a large law firm in Atlanta, national firm based in Atlanta. He said the number one deal killers in software is accounting errors, and that it's all tied to ARR. And so I would say the number one issue that we help companies, B2B SaaS companies in particular, solve is by being a system of record for billing and invoicing. We are the system of record for ARR and revenue reporting.
Interesting. What is your clients? Who is your perfect client, really?
So our ICP would be B2B SaaS. We have two different value props. We focus primarily on early stage growth startups. So think under enterprise for pre-revenue companies. So the guys in the garage have a great idea. They need to get paid. We have a billing product, which would compete with something like Stripe, where you have a billing portal. You can get customers up and running. You set up your SKUs, your price points, and people can sign up for your product and pay you for it. That's the core billing solution. The next inflection point, still in the ICP of B2B SaaS, but more targeted to the persona of an early stage CFO or head of finance, is really this revenue recognition. So CFOs, when you bring those on board, you're probably about 30 employees, call it $1 to $5 million. You have used a CPA or an accountant to do your reports. You move from cash to accrual accounting. You may have taken on some professional investors, and now revenue recognition matters. And so we have customers, that's the next inflection point. But honestly, Carol, we have customers who are using us for the invoicing and billing and reporting. We have 50 public companies that are using us within different divisions. We have about 100 companies that are greater than $100 million. So what we try to do is get in early when a CFO is thinking about their billing and financial operations and getting that all sorted. And then we grow with our customers.
So yeah, you stay with them throughout their journey. Got it.
That's right. That's the idea. Yeah.
So Maxio is private equity owned. You have about 2,300 customers. How did private equity enter the organization, and when?
It's a great question. It was an MOE, so a merger of equals, which is unusual in the M&A world. And we can talk a little bit about that if you want. But it was sponsored by a general partner at Battery, a woman named
Battery Chelsea Ventures.
Stoner. Yeah, Battery Ventures, who has been in the space forever, a wicked smart, one of those top 40 under 40 type investors. And she has been studying the office of the CFO with her team for years. They were the money behind Avalara. They were money in Intact. And what they saw was this opportunity to bring two things together, primarily sales-led motion invoicing. So you have a sales team that's doing your invoicing. And then there was this huge rise of product-led companies, so product-led growth companies that have more of a usage consumption model. And it was her idea to bring the two companies together, where you had legacy SaaS Optics, which had been around 12 years in the enterprise space, supporting more of a sales-led growth go-to-market acquisition model, and Chargeify, which was more of the PLG, and bring those two things together. So they came together in 2021. Again, about equal size in terms of customers, employees, and dollars. And they ran for about a year, and then they needed a new CEO, and they brought me on board to help bring the integration over the finish line and help us get into that next phase of growth.
So in looking a little bit at your background, as I talked a little bit about that in your bio, in the introduction, you know, you spent a good bit of time, you've done a lot of things starting, in the Naval Academy, right?
Yeah.
You in our first conversation talked a little bit about how your career has really been about three phases, right? The military, you as a journeyman, and leadership. Walk me a little bit through the first part of your career, you know, in the Navy, and then how you ended up getting into tech. And then subsequently thinking of yourself as a professional CEO.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. Well, in the military, I think is a great option for many people for different reasons. At my core, I believe every citizen of the Republic should do some service. It doesn't have to be military. It could be a teacher. It could be a firefighter. There are lots of things you can do. But as a Republic, we're not going to be viable unless you have this common identification of supporting the Republic. So for me, that was going into the military, the Navy. My grandfather had been in it, so I liked to sail boats. I thought, well, that'd be cool. And then going to the Naval Academy, I was fortunate to get in. It's a pretty competitive process. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go to the Navy, I'm going to try to go to the institution that tracks you to become the admiral one day. And what's really fun now is to see my friends who we were all graduated in 1990. The people that are still in are 2 and 3 star admirals. And I have a guy who's taking over Fifth Fleet in Japan. And he and I were together in English classes. And it's just awesome to see what these folks have been able to do. I ended up getting out for a variety of reasons, but I had been teaching at the Naval Academy at the time, had taken a Master of Arts in liberal arts, a great books program, thought I was going to teach. And it was my first lesson in business in terms of supply and demand. There's a whole lot of supply of English folks with PhDs.
Yes, there are.
And there isn't a whole
including
lot of demand.
Including my sister and her daughter, who is soon to be a PhD in English.
yeah. And it's almost a disservice that universities do for cranking out, taking the money and cranking out these PhDs into a job market, which doesn't exist. I was getting paid more as a lieutenant in the Naval Academy than we were offering tenure track positions. And this is in 1995, 1997. So it's really, I was like, huh, this isn't going to work. So where do I go? Right. Into industry, law school or business school. I had the good fortune to get into Harvard Business School. And at that point, as I will tell people, if you can get into one of the top 5 business schools, no matter what, go. It is transformative. The types of jobs I've had, the exposures I've had, I just would not have been the same if I hadn't gone. It was a great opportunity. At that time, I was in business school 98 to 2000, which was the heyday of the internet, if you remember. So 97 was when everyone was going nuts. And so if you were in business school, you had missed the boat. There was no way you were going to be successful. Everybody else was going to be rich and done. And I left in 2000. The choice I faced was I wanted to get into the internet. There were only 3 business models that were making money in the internet at the time, porn, gambling, and advertising.
Right.
And I don't think I could tell my mom that I was
going into porn.
Yeah, right. Advertising I thought was really interesting, Carol,
yeah.
because the promise of internet at the time was it was going to be a democratizing force. It was going to provide access to information and promote conversations and interactions across silos. And unfortunately, fast forward 20 something years, you see that primarily in social media, you have people ending up in their siloed echo chambers. But at that time, we thought what we were doing was creating access and democratizing the internet and funding it through advertising. And so I joined a startup that was started by a friend of mine, actually, from the Navy. And I would say the other point is from that point in 2000, I went into a company where the business model was web-based ASPs, application service providers, which is what we call SaaS today, or what Mark Benioff labeled the cloud, brilliant marketer. I was, a mouthful to say web-based ASPs. But I have been in this model as software delivered as a service. And how do you think about monetizing that software through a variety of options for, gosh, I guess, 23 years now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, before you, prior to you joining Maxio, you were, you've been doing a lot of different stuff, but you were directly at Seismic, correct?
Correct. Okay. Right. So I'd been CEO of a couple of companies, one of which Percolate, I ended up selling to Seismic.
Right.
And what I describe it as, it was a great opportunity for me to spend a couple of years detoxing from doing two turnarounds. Second point was watching a great CEO, Doug Winter, running a software company at scale and being super successful and having a seat at the table there. And the third thing for me was building some skills that I hadn't had before, which was I had been part of M&A, where I had been a company that I sold or had integrated, or when I was in Microsoft Salesforce, we integrated other companies, but I had never led M&A. And so learning that skill was something that I thought was worth doing for a couple of years. And when I looked for my next opportunity, as part of the reason why I went to a PE firm was, as you know, PE firms in general, I have lots of different types, but the ones I know most about are those that they buy a platform, or in this case, we talked about with Maxio, Battery brought two companies together to create a platform, and then they grow both through organic growth and then through inorganic growth by doing add-ons. And so I thought, oh, this would be a great way for me to continue that skills that I've been developing and a better understanding for how do you create companies through aggregation of assets over time.
So how did you find your way into Maxio exactly?
Well, I had the good fortune to be recruited to the last couple of jobs I've been at. I don't know how that you get your name out there, but I do think being in the Silicon Valley area, I live in Oakland, you start to get plugged into a broad set of networks. And there are a few recruiters that tend to have the lock on VCs and PEs.
Yep.
And so if you get into their network, like my first job, it was Heidrick Struggles. Mm-hmm. That recruited me to go into, or was running the CEO search at Rocket Fuel. I was already an internal candidate, but I got to know them. And then there was another one that found me to go to Percolate. I forget who that was. And then I've used these firms to help me find executives. And so I do think this is one of those, it's like the mafia, right? Like every VC and PE firm has a head of HR.
Don't get me started.
They do. They have their own network. Mm-hmm. They have their portfolio of executives. They have people that have run companies for them before, and they use those people first. And then they have their preferred set of recruiters that they use for specific roles, CEO, head of sales, head of customer success. When you get in their network, you're in their database. And someone reached out to me and said, hey, I've got an interesting battery opportunity. I was biking and skiing. I was, having a great life. I was like, oh, battery. Well, that was my first criteria. I wanted to work with a top tier financial firm, specifically a PE firm. I had friends who had worked at Battery. But it really is, Carol, this interesting dynamic of you got to be in the mix with the right people to get exposed. None of these opportunities are public.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
I know.
They're all reaching out to find people, extracting them from companies, or knowing that you're on the beach or you're sitting on the board. Part of the reason I moved from Seattle to San Francisco was to actually be able to build some of those relationships, either directly or indirectly, but just be in the mix.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because as somebody who was a professional headhunter for for decades, there are what you're describing as a professional headhunter, right? I perpetually laugh when I'm like, so how did you find that part? You know, why are you having so much trouble? I don't know. But you know, we've been posting ads. Well, that explains it.
Yeah.
Know, the best people are never looking for a job, really. Yeah. There are exceptions, but
it's always, and your position as a candidate, you have different power if you're in a job versus if you're looking, especially in this market. I have a lot of friends that are in B2B SaaS. I don't know if you saw that recent article by TechCrunch, which was quoting someone else, but 240,000 layoffs this year.
I didn't see that.
Which is 50% more than all of last year. And a lot of it's the people, like the broader economy is doing okay, but in the B2B tech world, there's this recession, and it is having domino effects in terms of companies laying off people, their willingness to buy software. But a lot of my friends and colleagues are on the beach, you know, for no fault of their own, except for the funding environment has changed dramatically. The interest rates have gone up. It's no longer free cash. And the reality for what it means to run a software company successfully is radically different than it was even 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting. And of course, there will be more tech layoffs coming now that Broadcom just bought VMware. That was just announced yesterday, although.
I think what you find is the early companies that are living, you know, hand to mouth in terms of if they're back with VCs, it used to be, hey, you need to have enough cash for 18 months, 6 months to kind of operate, and then 12 months to get your next round going. I had many friends, CEO friends, who said all of a sudden that changed from 18 months to 36 months. And a bunch of the small companies went, whoop, now what am I going to do? And they had to go sell. And so there's this flurry of activity in small companies. But then I think over the last 6 to 9 months, you've seen the big guys like Microsoft and Facebook and Salesforce all doing massive layoffs, VMware. And so you're getting the whales are shedding talent now too.
Well, and really, and you know, the reasons for that are, I think, a much longer conversation, but I think a great deal of the mammoth companies doing this, they're all publicly traded companies.
Of course.
And there's a very different dynamic among those companies and who they have to answer to versus a privately held company or a, you know, PE owned company that doesn't have the market to answer to necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've only had one shot as a public company CEO, and it wasn't that long. But I will confirm and validate your point. Your board is constructed very differently.
Correct.
In terms of the type of people that are on your board. Mm-hmm. They're not investors. We only had one investor that's gone through. The rest of the folks were senior luminaries and well-established folks in broad advertising. They're representing public investors. You have big firms, investment firms, and how they invest. And so it's really different than you're in with a VC and they're meeting with you every month and they know your business really well and are tracking your burn rates. And it is different. I say the other thing that's really hard to do is a transformation in the public markets because public investors often don't have an appetite for the 3 to 5 year play. They're focused on what are you doing next quarter? You just saw that with, oh gosh, it was a public company that beat their earnings. I mean, you're hearing this more and more for the quarter, but they lowered their forecast for the full year and their stock dropped by 40% because of the compound impact of what the growth rate expectations were going to be. And so it really is a, be careful what you wish for if you want to be a public company.
I agree. Randy, from a marketing standpoint, how are you finding your customers?
Yeah, well, you know, this has been one of the biggest challenges, Carol, because I came from a world of selling for 21 years, participating, selling technology to advertisers and marketers. And so I know how to reach those folks. The challenge is we're selling to CFOs, and CFOs are like the elusive bird.
Yes, they are.
They don't go to conferences. there are CFO conferences, but often that's the large enterprise folks, but they're going to other conferences. You don't know where they are. They don't like to spend money, especially in this environment when they are telling all the other functional leaders to cut back on their software spend. And so it is really hard. I think what we are finding is the majority of people find us through search or referrals. The referrals come from the CFO mafia. And what I mean by that is there are these groups, like if you're at a VC or PE firm, you'll have a Slack group for CFOs or a Slack group for CEOs. And when a CFO has a question about technology, they'll reach out to the other CFOs in that portfolio. The other mafia, there's this group called F-Suite, And it's, I think it's just a group of CFOs nationally that are in software and they share best practices, et cetera. So it's, I think it's really hard. What we've tried to do is partner with some technology partners and go-to-market partners to create compelling content, either through webinars or in-person events, to bring people together and focus on building community versus pushing products. It's a play that everybody does, but it's hard to get CFOs to come out.
You know, I know you don't want to talk about your ARR, but if we can talk a little bit about the percentage of growth you've experienced, even just over the last year and a half since you've been at the helm, and what you would say that's due to?
Yeah, what I'll say is there's a report that we have called the Maxio Institute Growth Report that we've published now three times, and be happy to put it in the show notes or sell it with folks. We across our 2,300 customers, we've aggregated the data for 1,500 customers, and we break out by stage, so how big the customers are, by revenue, by segments, and by go-to-market model, PLG, SLG, what the growth rates are. What you saw in Q1 of 2022 was up to 30%, Q1 2022. And in Q1 of 2023, it dropped to 13%. Q2, it's been 15%. And Q3, the data hot off the presses is 16%. So flattened out. Maxio is north of that. I won't get into the specifics, but I will say because our company is sold to B2B SaaS companies, when you see that sort of contraction in the market across our growth, our company's growth profile, that impacts us as well. So I think we are, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. Mm-hmm. When SaaS was growing like crazy, our company was growing like crazy. Because our business model is interesting, we price based primarily on a percent of revenue. So unlike many SaaS companies, and this is part of the reason I came here because it was different, many SaaS companies, you sell a platform fee, maybe you sell seats, you try to cross the divisions or you try to sell new features, but you have this predictable revenue tied to number of units, seats. In a business model that's based on revenue, totally depends on the company's growth rates. So our success is dependent on our customer success. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And to step back, talking about what we were talking about with, you know, who your customers are and so on and so forth, what would you say is the, do you believe that, you know, if we do hit the big R recession, which I'm now starting to hear, you know, people talk about other than just, you know, the general person on the street who's feeling like we've been in a recession for the last year and a half.
Right.
You know, the last piece of that is the, you know, job contractions, right? And layoffs.
Yep.
That's the last piece. If we hit that, then we're in a recession. But
right.
I'm wondering, since you're selling primarily to small companies,
yeah,
if that's going to affect you. I mean, I would think it wouldn't because of what we were talking about with how the large publicly traded companies are the ones that are always going to, I shouldn't say always, they will be primarily the ones that are doing the big layoffs.
Yeah, I think what you see in our churn codes is a lot of companies are declining, going out of business or being acquired. So to my earlier point, if you're an early stage B2B SaaS company, you're running out of cash, you're looking for a safe harbor to park your company. And so we are seeing that acquisition as a dimension. I think B2B software has probably already gone through its recession. And so what we're showing from our data is we're coming out the other side. I don't think it's going to be, the growth rates are going to be the heady days of 2021 and 2022. So I think we've already got our reset. I would offer that a technology like Maxio is a must-have for companies who want to get funded and stay funded. And so it's both in growth markets and I would argue in recessionary times, because you're trying to figure out how your cash flow is.
Yeah,
and super important. What's happening. And to do that, if you're doing a SaaS model where you have subscriptions, you have to manage subscriptions, manage the renewals, understand your ARR, MRR schedule, your ARR waterfalls, your different cohorts. And if you don't have that, you're doing it in Excel and it's an absolute nightmare. So I think there are CFOs out there who just want to gut it out because they're really comfortable with Excel. And that's what they're used to doing, is building bottoms up models. And they're really going to know every single element cell in every single Excel file. I remember when I was at Berkeley, we at that time were about 30, we sold, I don't know, $35, $36 million. And we didn't have a whole bunch of customers, but, you know, hundreds. And you'd press the Excel model, and Excel would take 3-5 seconds for it to update, just because it was, you know, 50 tabs and all these different formulas. And it was mind-boggling. That's where I first got exposed to Maxio, the legacy SaaS Optics division. Was we brought that on board, and it changed my CFO's life. We went from spending the first 8 to 10 days, well, the CFO spending the first 8 to 10 days closing the books, then the next 8 to 10 days trying to figure out what just happened using Excel files, to on day one, we could press a button and we could see what our ARR and revenue was. So I could spend, not the whole month, but I would spend time like, oh, well, how did our new pricing strategy work? What's happening with churn? What's happening with win rates, by product, by segment, by region? And so it provides really incredible insights. And I think that my point to your question is, as companies move through this reset, B2B companies are going to continue to sell software. SaaS, as a projection of total growth, is outgrowing the economy. Those companies are going to need technology to help them drive efficiency and effectiveness in their financial operations.
Randy, what would you say is the competitive nature of your business? I mean, do you have other competitors out there? Where do you fit in at Max? Where does Maxio fit in?
So we tried to, when I came on board, we tried to get very clear about a narrow ICP. I think when you're a smaller company, you want to understand which category you're competing in. One of my favorite books is Playing Bigger, which is all about category creation. And part of what they describe is, you know, what corner of the room are you in? What do you do that's differentiated compared to everyone else? So we said we were B2B. So there are a bunch of people out there, not a bunch, but there are several out there that do B2C and e-commerce, but we do B2B. We also cut by segment. We said we're only going to do mid-market. So mid-market and below. We're not S of SMB because we don't have a PLG motion. So we're a little bit above S. We're a little bit below enterprise, and we're only in B2B.
Right.
In that category, as defined, we're the category leader. But, just define the category small enough and you can be the leader. What you would see is where we compete is on that early stage company that's looking for a billing solution. Stripe is often a default for payments, and they're moving into billings. We have a bunch of people who move from Stripe to us. We can get into why that's true. There are other players. That's a super competitive space in terms of billing, and usage-based billing is becoming really hot. Lots of companies that are getting funded and trying to make sense of all this crazy data, all the AI companies, how they think about usage-based pricing, what does that mean? So all the VC companies that are investing in the new AI startups, all those folks need to figure out what their pricing model is, pricing strategy. They need stuff like what we got. So a lot of competitors down there. At the super high end, there's a company out there called Zora, a guy named Qin Zhao, I knew at Salesforce. He spun this out and he wrote the book Subscribed, which is all about the subscription economy. But they are for like digital transformation. And then there are companies out there like NetSuite and Intacct, which are primarily a general ledger or an ERP that have some modules which we compete with as point solutions. So we have different competitive dynamics depending on where we are segment and capability wise, all viable competitors, and you know, make it interesting.
So Randy, you mentioned, and I am curious to hear more about this, that people have, some of your customers were with Stripe and came with Maxio. So what's been the impetus behind that for them?
So Stripe, I think, is a wonderful company in terms of developer first. They're there for the early stage. Remember, I focus on software. So they make it super easy for people who have a little bit of technical background. Usually software companies are founded by, you know, engineers, CTOs or the CEO or product folks. They have APIs and SDKs. You go and you get your thing up and running. You make your own SKUs and you're off and running. The challenge with Stripe is it's designed for developers. And so if you start to work with a CPA firm or you bring on a finance person, they're not developers. And they need more of an intuitive interface that's, the starting point is, how do you think about the world through the lens of finance and accounting? And then as CEO at that point, you're like, well, I don't want to have my developers focused on a billing solution. I need them building our core code. So you have this inflection point where your developer resources need to be doing that. You need your finance team is like, I can't get anything done with my pricing catalog. without a developer. And so you hit this inflection point. And the other thing I would say is Stripe, in terms of billing, is not as robust in the ability to take on complicated, complex billing models. So we were talking about usage, et cetera. So there's a couple of specific use cases. And then I just think there's a business model difference in terms of people migrating from Stripe to us. The actual price you pay for billing or payments, payment processing is almost commoditized. So we have many customers who use Stripe that use us, and then many customers who've moved from Stripe to have Maxio payments because we're also doing billing and invoicing for them. And you put all that data together, now you have all one system of truth across that, which helps provide additional insights.
Randy, if you look at your history as a CEO, what would you say are, I know there's gonna be more than we have time to talk about here, but what would you say are some of the mistakes you've made along the way? And like, when did the epiphanies happen, and what have you done to correct those things over the years?
I think there's a couple of things. One is, as a CEO coming in without a finance background to a venture-backed company, is getting super clear on the capital structure. How much money has been invested? What are the expectations of the different investors in terms of when they came in, their valuation? And if you are doing a transformation, your opportunity to do a recap is when you're coming in the door, not when you're there. And so I think at Percolate, there was probably an opportunity for me to say, hey, look, I like this business where we know we have to take a strategic turn. It's going to require new capital. And I don't think we're going to be able to raise capital based on where we are with our current valuation. Guess what? That proved to be true. And I was able to raise some money, but not all money. We ended up having to take a big debt load. And then that would be the second lesson, is just be super careful about debt, right? At the end of the day, you've got to pay back the bank. Equity investors can go with a zero, but debt, you're like personally liable. And so I think those ideas around capital structure, and if you don't have a background there, it's worth either making sure. I didn't have a CFO at the time at Percolate, and we had cycled on one. So when I joined, maybe the advice is just making sure that you've got, if you're coming in as the new CEO, the CFO is someone that you're going to really be able to rely on, who's got their fingers on the pulse and who's going to join you in a recap if that's what's needed. I actually ended up going, I think I mentioned I went to business school. I went back and took a course at Stanford on finance for non-finance executives after I sold the company, in part because I wanted to know what the heck just happened. I mean, I'd studied this stuff back in business school 20 years prior, but it'd been a long time. And I was in the fight the whole time, and coming out of it, I was like, oh, well, that was what was going on. And I didn't fully appreciate those nuances. So going to a private equity backed company, they have a $4 billion fund that they're investing out of. Raising capital is not going to be an issue.
Right.
I had to create a business that was worth investing in, but I wasn't going to have to go out and get new investors, which was the lesson learned for me from that situation. And there are probably more I can talk to you about if you're interested, but that's probably the biggest lesson learned so far.
Right. So there is one more, and I'm going to be very specific. As a leader, what are some, or a bigger mistake that you made, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah. I would say a couple, maybe. One is, I have this great adage that in the military, you talk about lead, follower, get out of the way. And that idea is like, I'm okay if you're going to be the leader, just make the decision. I'm happy to follow. I'll be the leader if no one else is going to be, and I'm going to step into the breach and do it. Coming into the corporate sector, especially at larger companies, I describe it as lead, follow, let's talk about it. And I'm like, what do you mean, let's talk about it? Is it your decision? Is it my decision? Right. What's going on? And it depends. I was probably a little too hard on people trying to force accountability. Like, look, and it came from this place of, I don't care. Just let's articulate what the decision is. How are we going to make the decision? And then you need to be accountable for it if you're going to take it. And I think you have in larger organizations in particular, everybody wants the veto, but no one wants to stand up and own it. And so I would say that lesson of how to translate military mindset to corporate sector, play nice, was one of them.
Yep, that doesn't surprise me.
I'll tell you another lesson, which everybody says is fire quickly, hire slowly. I think as a CEO, when you walk in the door, if you're coming in as a professional CEO, something's wrong. And you need to spend 90 days figuring out, and you'll get 90 days from the board to figure out your strategy. You also need to assess your team, and you probably need to pick one person who's going to be the one you move quickly on. And then that kind of sends a message to the rest of the entire company that there's a new sheriff in town and things are going to be done differently. And your expectation, I think, when people bring you in is there's going to be a bit of a shift in terms of executives. And I think that is something you've got to be really clear of the board on is what is the set of capabilities you have at this stage? What's the set of capabilities you need for the next stage you're going to? And who can grow into that? And you hope that the people you have on staff can. And then who are you're going to have to replace to get that next level of player on the team?
Yeah. What would you say are the biggest opportunities and threats in your space right now?
Well, I think our number one challenge to people buying is what we were talking about a little bit before. Status quo is good enough. So I think of us in the Jeffrey Moore crossing the chasm. When we have early adopters, get it. They love it. Our best customers are those that are repeat customers. Cause like me, I used it. I was like, oh my God, this changed my life. But to get people, especially CFOs that are a little bit more reticent to adopt new technologies in general, that's part of the reason why I came into this function was sales and marketing and service have all been transformed by workflow automation. The office of the CFO hasn't. There's reasons why. Finance folks need to be accountable for every single dollar, every single nickel, every single penny. So they don't want to take on new technology. But that is our biggest challenge is getting, Carol, every single company, every single B2B company needs what we got. Now, they may not need it from us, but I'm telling you, if you're going to run an efficient B2B SaaS company, you need RevRec. You need revenue reporting. You need to be able to look at your customers by cohorts. It's absolutely critical. And I don't think that, and you can do it by Excel, but I don't think that's going to be the way it's going to go going forward. So it's for us, it's a little bit of just this crossing the chasm. How do you get from the early adopter to lead user to the early majority? Number two, our biggest opportunity threat is our customers, when they get to about 50, 70 million bucks, many of them are told they have to go to NetSuite. 90% of them go to NetSuite, 10% go to Intacct, because now those companies are bought by PE firms who want compliance and governance that QuickBooks Online doesn't provide. So we end up with this really interesting, almost ceiling to how long a customer can run with us. And we've got all sorts of plays we're working on. And there are many companies, like even QuickBooks has to wrestle with that. They're losing customers to NetSuite. But we can help companies extend their QuickBooks integration way beyond when many PVC firms are saying you need to go to NetSuite. And NetSuite is really expensive. The implementations are really expensive. It takes a long time, sucks up an enormous number of calories and cycles. But eventually the very best company, not the very best, but the companies that have grown the largest are going to move. And so that's a threat for us as well, I think.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think that's, you know, the challenge, I think, for many companies is, to your point, NetSuite's been around a long time and it's a really recognized name. And, you know, those firms that are pushing the company into making that move, you know, have a great deal of power.
Yeah.
with the company, right?
Yeah.
To say, hey, here's where you are. You need to move because you need all the rest of this. I have to wonder, Randy, if the governance that you talk about and those types of things aren't those things that you can eventually add?
Well, we're not going to build a general ledger.
It's nuts. It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Right. That is a capability that at the core of every finance team, the ERP general ledger. Now they've added module. I mean, they're a platform with lots of different modules. And so our billing solution, I would argue, is better than NetSuite and Zone Billing, who they have partnership with. Our revenue recognition reporting for B2B SaaS companies, especially those with usage models, is better than their ARM module. So then it just becomes, if you have a general ledger, do you buy NetSuite just to be a general ledger and then use us for these other capabilities and modules? So it's how do you play in that co-opetition, the ecosystem, well, and then help your customers make that case. because the PE firms are saying, no, just go all in on NetSuite. We got to deal with NetSuite. And that's what Oracle does, right? They show up with 20,000 salespeople who are selling at the PE level and at the portfolio level, and they got a bunch of money and they sign multi-year contracts with the PE firms. And I get it from a PE perspective. It's great to standardize on a NetSuite practice or an Intacct practice. But this is where disruption happens. This is where companies like ours are able to pick off pieces and say, we do this better than they do. And we should,
Do you want best of breed or, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it may simplify it too much, but that's really, I think, just as simple as it can be. I mean, do you want best of breed or don't you? I don't want to pick on Oracle, but you mentioned Oracle, so I will. I had a friend who worked for Oracle via the JD Edwards acquisition many years ago. And I'd say to him, you do realize Oracle doesn't even by a long shot have the best products, right?
Yeah.
Oh, he gets so angry with me. And I thought, here's the deal. Oracle is, Larry Ellison was really smart. It's a marketing machine. It's like you can't even compete against that marketing, right? And people get to thinking, well, I have to buy one of Oracle's products. Well, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Nobody working for Oracle would be happy to hear me say that, but it's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. But I think, Oracle has very robust capabilities. I mean, the largest companies in the world are using their databases. They're a great database.
That's right. Well, all the other ones disappeared.
Yeah.
And we could talk about why they disappeared. Why did Ingress disappear? I had people saying Ingress was hands down the best database company of the four companies. Ingress, Informix, Oracle, and Sybase. And why did they disappear? Because they wouldn't spend money on marketing.
Yeah. So I think it's one of the great challenges of being in a software company is when you have these whales out there, how do you play pilot fish? How do you tuck in around them and their ecosystem, play in their marketplace? I mean, it's what Mark did to Siebel. Mark Benioff of Salesforce
and
how he took them out. And, he started there and then came over, started a new company and basically ate their lunch. You have to have differentiated capability and value prop, but then he's a brilliant marketer but it's inspiring. I mean, that's what makes it fun is you're in the octagon and, how do you survive long enough to get big enough?
Right. Well, and Tom Siebel did the same thing, right? He built an amazing company and Oracle was not happy about that, right?
Yeah.
So Oracle tried to build its own competitive product and couldn't and ended up, buying them for close to $6 billion.
Yeah.
Totally. Way back when, for those of us who are old enough to remember that, right? So, I mean, it's interesting. And I think, I think part of it is that buyers are not necessarily savvy.
Yeah.
In part.
Or they're time pressed.
Right.
They have a pain and they're not educated on terms of what the options are out there. And that's why marketing, that's why doing thought leadership, getting out there. So you're in the consideration set of, you have this type of problem. Oh, I've heard of Maxio you ask your friends. And so how do they get educated when I have a problem now, I need to fix this. And everyone talks about 90% of your buyers aren't in market. So how are you creating a big enough presence with the core group? And that's why we did a really tight ICP focus on a very specific persona so that we can try to be in that milieu. And maybe we open up and go after other companies over time, but we have a lot of row to hoe just in this space around B2B SaaS, targeting CEOs early stage and CFOs of that Series B, Series C type profile.
Right. So, Randy, you have about 240 employees currently. Tell me a little bit about your talent strategy and where you've seen challenges around that.
Yeah. So, we're fortunate in that we already have a global-based talent for a variety of reasons, but we have a lot of engineers in Krakow, Poland, and that's been great. We do have engineers in the U.S. as well. I would say our talent strategy is anywhere but Silicon Valley.
Because of the money?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the reason I joined the company was headquartered in Atlanta. I was from Atlanta. I felt it'd be nice to be around Southerners. I like those folks. But it's also just a different environment in terms of competition for talent. back when I, you know, was starting. And so we have employees in 25 states in the US. We have a go-to-market team based in Dublin. And then we have a center of excellence in the Philippines. And so it is, I invest in a company called Doxa, which is their mantra is borderless talent. I think the world that we're in today is borderless. And so then it's about, where do you get centers of excellence? So we have an engineering center of excellence, we have a go-to-market excellence, we have a back office center of excellence, and then working with time zones, et cetera. We're a mid-market company, so we can't afford the prices that the Microsofts and the Googles pay. So you've got the talent strategy is to convince people that you're changing the world and come join and be part of a company, build some skills and capabilities, get promoted quickly, get expanded responsibilities. So it's a grow your own strategy. We've invested a lot of enablement. So we've invested in bringing on university hires and helping them get that first job and then move up through the organization. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about being at this stage company versus when I was at Microsoft, or, you know, even when I was at Rocket Fuel, the public company. What was good at that point was I stepped into the CEO role with executives around me who had more experience than I did. And so just, you have this incredible, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be learning from you all the time. Now I'm older, you know, gray haired dude. Being at this stage company, I'm able to help younger folks kind of think about, well, how do I become a leader? How do I move from individual contributor to manager and develop management excellence? How do I move from manager to director and know what it means to direct things? And then how do I move from director to VP? And so it's this wonderful opportunity to invest in, give back. I've been, you know, thinking, practicing leadership since I went to Naval Academy when I was 18. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you build leadership capability? It's the thing that I am most interested in.
Yeah, I think that's terrific. How do you describe or define your culture?
I would say high IQ, high EQ, low ego, which is different than I think you see in some other centers of software, where you've got a little bit of high IQ, high ego, and low EQ. And it was part of the reason I was attracted by Maxio, was it was a Southern company. And guess what? People are just nicer.
I know.
And so if anything, I have to work to build constructive tension. And how are you going to actually engage people and grind out ideas and be okay with it and, you know, get in there and disagree and then commit? It, radically different than my experience at some of the bigger companies in software, where, you know, smartest person in the room won. And so they would look to make you look dumb, or, you know, ask questions to get you, take you to math camp. I used to call it take you to math camp, because they're looking at your, you know, your deck, and they found you were off by 0.1 in this one slide from that slide. Well, why did that happen? And I think there's just this default. The thing about Maxio is, you know, people are nice, and we're working hard, but we're trying to do it collectively. I'd say there's also this real strong sense, clearly with my background, I have a very strong orientation towards mission and building an idea, a company where you can do well and do good. So you return shareholder value, but you also invest in your community, you invest in your people. So I hope that people would come and say, gosh, this is a fun software company to be part of. I can be challenged, I can grow my skills, but I don't have to be just crushed through the, you know, the IQ hammerlock.
You know, I spent the first just over a decade of my career exclusively calling into the Southeastern United States. And that was like, you know, 98% the Atlanta area. And as I was listening to you, and we'll talk about this offline, I don't know how I never met you, but it just, I guess, worked out that way. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I would see... my calls were longer than like anybody else in the company.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have to chat with people in the South.
Yeah. Yeah.
They want to get to know you. And that, you know, that I would never have wanted to cover the New York metro area, even though I lived in New Jersey. You know, I just thought, oh God, you know, people are just a little too, it's hard enough living here. I don't want to have to work with people here too. You know?
Yeah. It's funny because I was born in New York, lived in the Northeast, spent high school in Atlanta, and came out to the Silicon Valley after business school. We didn't spend much time in the military. And I would say what I've had to learn, going back to one of your leadership lessons, is I tended to build relationships through the work. Meaning, I don't care that much about your wife, your husband, your dogs, your kids. I mean, I do, but I'm much more interested in let's go solve problems together. And part of the feedback I got is that shows up as too intense. And people want to get to know
That's
you.
Right.
And I'm like, well, look, I'm not that interesting. Let's just go fix problems. And we actually start with our executive meetings. We have this thing called the round of good, where we spend 15 minutes and people go around and say, hey, what was something good that happened over the last week? And I'm there like biting my nails. Well, really? We're going to waste 15 minutes of our 2 hours talking about the round of good? But I do think it has led to our rebuilding trust, laughter. It's a really nice way to start off a meeting.
I'm in a cohort. We do the same thing.
Oh,
in a cohort that I'm in right now.
I think it's required in the South.
Yeah.
There's a presupposition that you're going to spend a little time social chit chat, talking about Georgia football. You know, what you're doing on the weekends, and it's a little slower, and it's fun.
There's something to be said for that.
It grounds you back. It grounds you back into the kind of like life is more than just transaction, which I think can often be the software model.
Randy, if somebody listening to this podcast is thinking, God, this sounds like such an awesome company. Gosh, I'd really be interested in working for them. What should they do?
Well, I mean, you can go to our site, maxio.com. I think we have our, we're hiring. There are roles available there. You can follow us on LinkedIn to see. I think we post roles there and on Facebook. You can follow me on LinkedIn. And then if there's something that you think you're doing that we'd love to chat about, I'd be delighted to chat. And it's randy.wootton, W-O-O-T-T-O-N. So two O's, two T's, O-N, at maxio.com.
Awesome. I love it when a CEO is willing to give out that email address. Is there anything we haven't covered that I haven't asked you about that you want to talk about before we sign off?
No, Carol, I think you've been great. I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about life, a little bit about business, lessons learned. It's been a fun opportunity to kind of reflect on some of those broader themes and remind me that I need to go back and spend a little bit more time in empathy and emotional intelligence. So I got some ideas for doing that after we get off this call.
Well, Randy Wootton, CEO of Maxio. I can't say it any better than that myself. Thanks so much. This is really a fun conversation.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Authentically Successful Show. Don't forget to click follow to hear more, and please leave us an honest review and rating so we can continue to improve and bring you more great stories. If you're interested in being my next guest, please check the episode description for information to apply. This is Carol Schultz. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.